My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast for episode number 100. Balder, how do you feel after 100 long episodes of the Western Bubble podcast? Because we're not counting all the extra episodes we did, because with those we reached 100 a while ago.
Well, Dario, I think we should first congratulate each other on this and the listeners for spending all of this time with us. It's been really fun to do these past 100 episodes, and it's been really interesting and good to see positive feedback and also critical feedback at times, and see numbers rise of listeners. All of that has been a great experience. Having said that, I don't think our podcast is really improving the world, because the world has gone down in a downward spiral since we started recording. So in that sense, I wish that we had a little bit more impact on global affairs.
That would be very nice. That would be very nice indeed. One of my favorite things about the last 3 years has been sometimes, right, we are surprised by who listens to the podcast, right? Because it's always a bit of a creepy moment when someone in the real world approaches you and again talks to you about your thoughts, and you think, one second, I've never talked to you about this. But then you remember, oh, I talk about this almost every week. For about 45 minutes to an hour. And so people obviously, right, they listen to you, they feel like they know you, and then they approach you and they kind of at you with like, oh, here's a very specific point I wanted to talk to you about. And you're like, oh, one second, this must have been like 2 years ago, an episode, I don't know what, one second, let me remember what I talked about.
Indeed. And it also leads to kind of unforeseen circumstances that at some point, if you'll remember, we got a very angry email from someone about something we said. And we replied back, and that person also happened to live in Madrid. And since then, I had like 4 or 5 lunch meetings with this person and managed to actually get into really interesting conversations, right? Most of our listeners actually don't come from Madrid or from Berlin, unfortunately, because otherwise we could meet them much more often. But some unforeseen interesting things come out of that.
Yeah, very much. I mean, well, the majority of our listeners, as you said, do not come from the area around us. But that leads to even funnier interactions, where I remember a few months ago, we had this email or this interaction with a student who basically said, oh, yeah, you know, someone from this little town in the United States, professor, actually talked to me about the Western Bubble podcast. And right, that's then very surprising when you think about the fact that there are people all over the world, right? We get to see the stats, we get to see what countries our listeners come from. And suddenly you realize that people all over the world are talking about the Western Bubble.
And I don't think I'm exaggerating. You're more into these stats. You have more access to them than I do. But I'm not exaggerating when I say that they really come from all over the world, right? Australia, Southeast Asia, North America, South America, Europe, even Sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, South Africa.
Yeah, everywhere. It's a nice little map, right? Even someone from Hawaii. That one is easy to spot, because suddenly there's a red dot, right, in the middle of the ocean. You're like, oh, what's that, right? And there's from Mongolia, right? Also Azerbaijan, Armenia. It's really everywhere, right? I mean, of course, the majority of our listeners come from the West. I would say, right, there's a lot of Europe and the United States. I think there's also, right, an interest in kind of listening to these topics. But it's always nice to see that they're really from all over the world. And that makes me feel really good, right? Even in New Zealand. Hello, New Zealand.
Well, it's interesting. So New Zealand and Australia, in many ways, are often considered part of the West, of course, despite their geographic location. I think the experience, at least how I receive feedback often, is a little bit different from someone who lives in Europe or Western countries on the one hand, and someone from, let's say, China or Nigeria on the other. I think the difference is that we are basically talking to Western audiences because we are critically looking at the West. We typically don't criticize China. We typically don't criticize countries outside of the West, because that's not our place. Who are we to do that? And so people from Western countries like us, they react slightly differently and often a little bit more agitated, a little bit more like, oh, you're pushing some painful buttons here. And I've been brought up to think that democracy is always the best thing. I've been brought up to think that we are somehow morally superior to others. And that leads to often a more complex interaction, whereas people from other parts of the world, they listen to it, I think, more to confirm what they already knew. Like, yeah, finally, someone who from Europe is saying what everyone else is obviously seeing from the outside, right? That you are overly arrogant as the West, that you are that you're walking around with severe delusions about how the world operates, etc., etc.
Exactly. I particularly received this feedback with our listeners from India. Right, because that's one of those regions that's kind of becoming more important in international relations in this multipolar world that we're moving into. And for them, it's very much this thing of, oh, finally, someone is acknowledging that it's not just the West and then the rest and everyone has to cater to them. But know that we have our own interests and our own ways and visions of how to form the future. So, yeah, the shout out to everyone from India. Hi.
Indeed. Besides the content that has, of course, changed with the time. One thing that for me really stands out, if I look back at the past few years, is how we have streamlined the podcast, right? I'm always a little bit embarrassed to refer people to the earlier episodes, the first summer that we just basically experimented a little bit, because it was all a little bit less fluent. It was all fluid. It was all a little bit less comfortable, and I find it sometimes difficult to listen to it now, right? You can see that at least the methodology and the structure of our recordings has improved quite a bit. Also by the fact that we hardly ever edit anymore, whereas in the past we used to edit quite a lot.
Just thinking back to the summer of 2022, I think we started this project in June, but our first episode we only published in July. So we spent a whole month, right, of refining the concept, the methodology, making sure that we have a... I think we recorded quite a few practice episodes and we're very unhappy with them. And it took us a whole month and then we finally published our first episode. Do you remember what the first episode was?
It must have been about... I would think about introducing the Western bubble, right? What is the Western bubble, surely?
Exactly. So that's episode zero, right? That's what I call the trailer. But fun fact, and I do not remember why... we actually published this episode 3 days after we published episode one.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what happened. Something must have happened. But basically, we talked about the war in Ukraine in episode one on July 7th. And on July 10th, we talked about why the Western bubble. That's our trailer episode.
We were struggling at the time and we were still... And basically, we didn't advertise it at all. And I think we had about 10 listeners or something like that at the time because nobody knew it existed and we were just trying things out, right?
Exactly. We really only started advertising the podcast in September of 2022 when we had already quite a few episodes recorded because we wanted to really just like kind of go out there with a statement and say, hey, it's not only one episode, but you can already look at 10 episodes because the first episode we advertised was on human rights. And that one, I remember, that's still one of our, up until today, one of our most popular episodes that also, right, I mean, because we can see when people listen to them. And I think it's pretty clear that people are no longer listening to our first episode on Ukraine because there have been many more episodes on Ukraine. But the one on human rights, still on a regular basis, every week there's people listening to it because I think it is one of those very timeless episodes where you kind of look back at them and it really hasn't changed very much from back then. There's one more thing I want to talk about, and that was a decision I made in July of 2022. Because when I uploaded the first few episodes, I thought, oh, I obviously have to give these episodes a number. And I thought about, okay, I should do, you know what, I should put hashtag one. I thought, no, you know what, this is going to be a long-term project. I'm manifesting this now. We're not going to end this. So instead of, I didn't even put 01. Because, right, it would have meant, oh, we're only going up for double digits. No, I said 001. Because I knew at some point we're going to record episode 100. And see?
Here we are.
Only 2.5 years later, exactly, here we are.
Excellent. That's some foresight that you had there, Dario. Very, very good. And now I'm starting to get worried. What happens when we get to episode 1,000? Then we're in trouble.
Yeah, then we need to hire a person who goes back all the other episodes and basically puts down 0001.
By the way, you say hire a person. We should probably give credit, not necessarily naming everyone, but credit to a lot of people who have been part of this process, right? Researchers, editors, and all that. We should name them because we don't know if they want to be named, but there have been a lot of people who are not voicing these episodes, but who are working behind the scenes. So many thanks to them as well.
Exactly, very much. I also to the ones who are currently working with us, right, and helping us produce content for social media, helping us, right, sometimes research things. That's absolutely right. It's amazing for us. It's incredible work they do. But now I would like to move on to kind of the main part of this episode, and that is looking back. Looking back at some of the, I don't know if you can call them highlights. I think from a podcast perspective, you can certainly call them highlights. I think from an international relations perspective, some of them aren't really considered highlights. But we basically want to take you, the listeners, now through the evolution of this podcast, The Western Bubble, since the year 2022. And we actually thought we would start with a bit of a quick fire, because there was a period in time in 2023 when we were weirdly obsessed with talking about individuals, where we said let's only talk about a certain person, and to me that was it was great, right? Because some interesting developments came out of this, and the first person we talked about was Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson and Joe Biden, right? When they had a little back and forth. And my question is now, Boulder, where is Tucker Carlson? Is he still there? He's no longer on Fox.
No. He was disgraced, of course, at the time because of the whole the accusations that they made about election tampering. And then the producer, the manufacturer of election machines, actually sued Fox News and sued directly Carlson. And I think I'm correct to say that Fox News had to pay something like $700 million in damages. And part of that was also that Carlson was basically thrown out. I believe then he went to do his own thing, if I'm correct, somewhere. But he's definitely gone off the radar. He's nowhere near as influential as he was at the time. Because at the time, he was the main voice for Fox News and for right-wing America. It's kind of similar to a person that I think we've mentioned but never specifically spoke about, Bill O'Reilly, who was before Tucker Carlson the main conservative voice for Fox News, who then got into some kind of sex scandal, or at least he had been predatory to colleagues at Fox, and he was thrown out and also essentially disappeared, right? So there's this clear process of them having a relatively short period of success, and then they dig their own grave somehow.
Yeah, very much. I mean, Tucker Carlson, I mean, he's no longer on our radar. He still exists. Remember, there was the interview he did with Putin.
Oh, right. And where he was impressed with supermarkets who had trolleys that everyone in Europe has, but somehow that showed that Russian civilization was far above everyone else.
Exactly. And then actually just a few weeks ago, he interviewed Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia. But I think you can clearly see that because he's no longer on our radar, right, that Putin interview still got a lot of echo. That one of Lavrov, I only remember reading somewhere on a small note. And Tucker Carlson is still very good friends with Viktor Orban. And they visit each other once in a while and talk to each other. And that's about it. Like, right, he just has this little internet show on the and publishes it somewhere.
But even though I'm sure that we are not his target audience, typically if people have impact, whether it's on the political right or political left, they come across our radar, right? So the fact that Tucker Carlson hasn't come across my radar at all for the past couple of years, except for exactly that interview you mentioned, that says something about his fall, right? His decline in influence.
And to the listeners who want to kind of go back and listen to what we said about him, right? That was one of the extra episodes in season two on May 2nd, 2023. And then we continued, right? So May, that summer of 2023, seems like it wasn't very active in international relations, because looking back on it from a today's perspective, where every week we're struggling to even like to pick one of the topics from the many, it seems like in 2023, it was more like let's create a foundational, like an intellectual foundation for this podcast. And let's talk about some of these thinkers that may have influenced thinking in the Western bubble. Because the next person was an episode on Francis Fukuyama, episode 37.
Yeah, and then Francis Fukuyama, of course, the most important moment in his career was in the 1990s when he put into words this overall delusion that was created about Western superiority, democracy, and the end of history. But as we already recognized, I'm sure, in that episode, since then he continued being a lecturer, he continues to be an important voice in international relations, and he's still doing that right now. I don't know exactly how old he is at the moment. He's getting on a bit, I guess, but he is still very much this academic with academic influence. The only problem he has is that the theory that he's known for is becoming less and less relevant because the United States under Trump has absolutely no interest in any conversations about the end of history.
Francis Fukuyama is 72 years old at the moment. And still every international relations student has to read him. But I think that the framing of that will change, right? Because when I had to read him for the first time in 2017, it was still this thing of, oh, you know, that promise wasn't really true. And I imagine if students read him now in 2025, it's more like a look at the crazy uncle, what he wrote back then. And can you imagine what it is like the world we live in right now?
Indeed, even though I would like to emphasize, which I'm sure I did then as well, is that he wasn't crazy. He was deluded, but he was a very intelligent analyst. And a lot of his analysis seemed to make perfect sense at the time. The fact that now it seems like a crazy uncle says a lot as well about how quickly things have changed, right?
A week later, we talked about Samuel P. Huntington, right, in episode 38. He's no longer with us, basically. But I remember having a lot of fun recording that episode, like not in the preparation for it, because I remember being very frustrated for having to read him again. But then talking about him was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you just mentioned Fukuyama in terms of crazy uncle. I think Huntington is that uncomfortable uncle on Thanksgiving, during Thanksgiving dinner, that is going to say some unpleasant things that are just cringeworthy and politically incorrect. Huntington, at the end of his life, became pretty dodgy in the way that he published things, talking about white babies needing to repopulate America and things like that. But that idea of clash of civilizations is still politically popular among certain groups, because this idea that we're in this perpetual struggle of us versus them, whoever us versus them is something that appeals to our darker parts of the psychology.
I was about to say, if the current political leaders in a lot of, well, in the United States, but also in parts of Europe, if they would read more and they would discover Huntington now, right? If that was published today, I think he would be a big star amongst them, right? Because, I mean, the hate that babies of, you know, that theory of white, we need more white babies. I mean, that's something we're hearing from people surrounding Trump, right? And that thing of the clash of civilizations, people can't move, right, into another country, the great replacement conspiracy theory, like all of that stuff is highly popular right now. I think Huntington would have a great time.
And once again, that contrast between Huntington and Fukuyama is then very interesting, because Fukuyama is complex. Fukuyama requires significant philosophical understanding. Huntington is sort of straightforward, appealing to our darker urges, to this fear for the enemy, this rivalry that we want to have in order to define who we are. So Huntington appeals to today's world, where everything has become more simplistic, everything has become more about the emotional state of mind rather than deep intellectual conversations. And Fukuyama, therefore, has become much less relevant because people don't want to deeply think about these issues anymore.
Well, and then the third episode in a row in 2023 that we recorded on an individual was episode 39 on June 7th, 2023. And it was on George W. Bush. And he's one of those characters who, again, now 2 years later, I think he's in a more favorable light in the in public perception than he was 2 years ago, because he has positioned himself as one of those neutral former presidents, so kind of not really wanting to do anything with Trump, trying to stay away from him as much as possible. And people are applauding him for that.
This is a fascinating example of how norms and the median has shifted in Western civilization over the past 25 years, because you were too young to remember this. But after the war on terror started, after 9/11, an invasion of Afghanistan, an invasion of Iraq, there was enormous outcry about how extremist George W. Bush and his agenda, his White House, were. The Patriot Act, damaging basic individual rights within the United States, starting these enormously bloody conflicts around the world. And we looked at George W. Bush as an absolute extremist. And now, compared to where we are now, he's actually kind of middle of the road. But that says much more about how we have shifted our perspective and what we think is right and wrong now compared to 25 years ago, rather than saying much about Bush himself, because Bush will not have changed his philosophy much, right? It's just that, if you like, society has shifted much more to the right, and therefore now he seems central.
Very much. Someone, like another person, who I don't think has changed his philosophy, but now appears a little bit more central, is Jordan Peterson, whom we talked about in episode 42 on July 6, 2023. Because we actually spoke about this right before this episode, where you kind of said that Jordan Peterson seems to have become irrelevant or kind of has lost steam. Right. And then I responded that I think he's like just his appeal is gone because the world has changed from, right, like, oh, the self-victimization of men, right, his fans, like Jordan Peterson's fans. And it moved towards this Andrew Tate type of character of like, okay, I'm not going to self-victimize myself. I'm going to, you know, go to the gym and get rich and, you know, and be a traditional man as I'm supposed to be.
And once again, that is fascinating from how society has changed because, so one of the problems that we have always had with Jordan Peterson is that he uses complex language. He comes across as an intellectual, but if you actually parse his words, if you actually look at what he's actually saying, there's nothing there, right? So he hides it behind some pseudo-intellectualism. And that I'm sure in the episode we discussed this, that pseudo-intellectualism that is essentially empty on the inside. But there was a whole army of people who listened to that and thought, oh, wow, this is so intelligent. This is brilliant. Without properly, I would argue, understand what he's saying. Now, in 2025, we are getting to a point that people are no longer impressed by pseudo-intellectualism because it sounds too complicated. They just want simple answers to and simple solutions to their problems. And Andrew Tate, or all those types of even Joe Rogan and people like that, are just simple, straight to the points without any nonsense around that, right? So new generations and certainly the world around us is less accommodating to any type of complexity, even the kind of fake complexity that Jordan Peterson puts out there.
Moving on to the stuff of nightmares, if you ask me. No, please, dear listeners, be aware and know that Balder and I both have nightmares when it comes to the following person. Right? It's almost a weird obsession we have with him, is that every time there's a bad article written by this person, we have to send it to each other and then just be upset on WhatsApp. We're like, can you believe what he just said there? That's terrible. And the person I'm talking about is Simon Tisdall from The Guardian, right? Who regularly writes on foreign policy there. And boy, what does he write, right? He's the perfect case study of the Western bubble.
Yeah, so Simon Tisdall and George W. Bush, one of them is a complete psychopath and the other one is responsible for the war in Iraq killing 500,000 people, right? Yeah, Tisdall, he is one of those people. Why we are so frustrated with him is that he comes from sort of the Guardian, the political left. And whereas you would expect them to have some kind of more nuanced, sophisticated view, he is a exponent of the worst type of Western bubble thinking that you can come across, right? That a little bit is in some ways similar to what you see with the Greens in Germany, the Green Party that we've criticized in the past, right? This kind of shift where all of a sudden the idea of going to war, the idea of violence, fighting dictatorships and authoritarianism is acceptable for the left and is even desirable and thereby, from our perspective, completely undoing all the hard work of critical left intellectualism that was built up over the past 60, 70 years.
One of my favorite things about the episode we recorded, we recorded two episodes, right? A main one and an extra episode, is that when you Google Simon Tisdall's name and you go to videos, our recordings are like in the top three of basically the search results. So knowing people like Tisdall, that they Google themselves once in a while, they probably even have a Google alert for themselves. I just enjoy the thought that this man has Googled himself in the past and then has to had to come across our episode. I'm sure he has listened to the first 5 minutes of our episode, and I'm sure that he has been pretty upset with us, but he didn't want to, you know, he just didn't want to give us the recognition by sending us an angry email demanding that, you know, that's a complete misrepresentation of whatever, you know, he believes.
Yeah. It's a fun little thought experiment, especially since we've become more popular, and the fact that we're there on Google, that's very very pleasant to know. I wonder how people like him, in general, I would argue, how the Guardian looks at itself, and if they are in any way self-critical, because it seems that these columnists and the Guardian editors in general have become almost shielded from any outside criticism, right? There's very little actual serious intellectual debate on the Guardian pages. On the op-eds are all going in the same direction. There are very few different voices. And so I don't know to what extent he's actually capable of accepting the criticism that comes from people like us, even if he were to hear it.
Like, dear Mr. Listal, in case you're listening to this, feel free to come onto the podcast. We would love to have a conversation with you, and we will try to remain calm.
No, we will remain calm, and we will have an hour-long pleasant conversation about the topics of your columns, about your words, and just see what perspectives there are. We're always open to be educated.
Exactly. You know, he might be right and we might be wrong. I mean, that can always be the case.
Absolutely. That's it's not the case. It's not the case here, but it's theoretically it's possible. Yeah.
Well, let's look at some of the topics that we've covered in the last 3 years, and let's see, maybe we were wrong about some of them. The first one I want to start with is obviously the topic of Ukraine, just because that's what the podcast started with, as I said earlier on, right on July 7th with the first episode. And back then, unfortunately, 2.5 years ago, unfortunately for all the Ukrainian civilian soldiers, for all the Russian soldiers, unfortunately, it seems like we were right, right? And back then we said that, hey, there is a window of opportunity to maybe end this conflict, or, you know, at least put, like, decrease the suffering. But we observed then that the West was basically prolonging this conflict by saying that, dear Ukraine, we will be on your side. We will fight this war with you until the end, so that you win and none of your borders have to be moved. Well, now 2.5 years later, and that's not very much the case, right? There was just a phone call between Trump and Putin where they basically, you know, it sounds like there will be a meeting soon. And then, I mean, basically the borders from 2.5 years ago, the way they were shifted, might be the borders in 2025 permanently, just with a small difference that a few 100,000 people more have died.
Yeah, basically carving up Ukrainian territory, and it was depressing to see how Zelensky had to desperately almost say, hey, hang on, we demand a voice in all of this, you know, as if that shouldn't already automatically be the case if two countries go to war, or basically one country invades another country. Yeah, so this happened when we recorded that episode that was still in the moment of relative euphoria about the failures of the Russian military. So this was still at the time that people in the West thought that Russia was exposed as an emperor without clothes, that they were gonna fold. There was speculation about Putin losing his probably his head, but certainly his presidency. There was a sense, a deluded sense in the West, that Russia had run empty and that they would be easily defeated by Ukrainian forces supported with NATO logistics. And that was, at the time already, ridiculously overly optimistic. And it led to exactly that. It led to a situation where NATO and Western countries in general basically signaled to Ukraine, we've got your back, just fight it out and you will get Crimea back. Who knows, maybe you can make Russia collapse or implode into different states. There was a lot of theory crafting about that. What would the end of Russia look like? People were completely deluded because of the short-term failures of the Russian military, short-term failures of strategic planning. And it's honestly painful that, in that sense, our countries, your country, my country, and the West in general, therefore has blood on its hands, because they should have said to Ukraine, look, Russia is a serious actor, this is horrible that this has happened, but let's, you now are at a high point, you've managed to show the world and the Russians that you can defend yourself, now it's time to go to the negotiating table. And Zelensky indicated at the time that he was open to it, and it was only because of Western influences that, you know, that nothing else happened. I should add to that that now there's a little bit of historical revisionism, because the Zelensky himself and the government lately are saying there was nothing for us to agree to at the time. Well, yeah, sure, that is true. But Ukrainians were playing with the idea of negotiating. So even though there was no specific peace plan yet, the opening of negotiations was shut down. Now, of course, in 2025, Zelensky can't fully admit to that, because that would make him a bad leader, because that gives him responsibility over the for the violence that's taken place over the past 2.5 years.
One topic that we've covered continuously for the last 2.5 years, closely connected to Ukraine, was the Nord Stream 2 bombing or explosion, right? Where, remember, suddenly this big gas pipeline between Russia and Germany, suddenly there was a big leak in there, a lot of methane escaped, and then, oh, unfortunately, you know, that connection was cut. And we criticized that, well, back then, that it was immediately pointed at Russia, right? We even did a very nice stakeholder analysis. That was actually one of my favorite episodes, right? Because you kind of really get to dive into international relations. That, by the way, was episode 27 on February 15th, 2023. And then we continuously talked about it because no one else talked about it, right? It's one of those things that's now, it's a given that we will never find out who it was. It must have been the Russians. And that's it.
Yeah. What is interesting, that there were a number of investigations opened by Denmark, by Sweden, by Germany. They didn't lead to anything. I would argue that now, at the time, I think, if I remember correctly, that we suggested that the greatest chance was the United States somehow directly being responsible. I think now my analysis has slightly shifted, that it is much more likely to be Ukrainian, and which was also an option that we mentioned at the time, by the way, a good option, but Ukrainian intelligence, maybe with support from Poland or maybe with support from the United States. I think that's still reasonable, but we will never fully know. And the fact that the media has never really tried to find out is to me still one of the great disappointments in Western media. How come that such a big event, a huge event, especially knowing about the energy crisis that exactly occurred around this time, and enormous inflation, which was very much related to energy supply from Russia. The fact that the media didn't want to find this out, that there was no investigative reporting except for a few that we also mentioned, is to me still an enormous negligence on behalf of newspapers, TV channels, etc., etc. And what is fascinating beyond that is that since then, there has been this continuous kind of accusation towards Russia about other pipelines or other kind of connections, right, in the Baltic Sea, where every month or so, you read some kind of accusation that Russia or China or some of our enemies has somehow sabotaged some kind of connections there. It almost seems as if we're now being just flooded with those kinds of accusations to forget that Nord Stream actually happened and definitely wasn't done by Russia.
It's crazy. It's crazy. I mean, it's, I don't know, right? I don't regularly think about Ukraine anymore in my daily life. For that, it has just become too much of our daily life in that sense. But if you really think about this in detail, it's outrageous.
No, but that's one of the things that happens when you become very tribal about these kinds of things as an outsider. So the fact that Ukraine does whatever they can to defend themselves, okay, that's, you know, understandable to a certain extent, right? I mean, you got invaded by an antagonistic enemy, by a country that is obviously a threat to you. You're gonna develop strategies and tactics to defend yourself in any way possible. But from an outsider's perspective, Ukraine has done some absolutely horrible things, and nobody seems to care about that, right? So assassinating civilians in Moscow or elsewhere, I mean, You're not supposed to do that. That goes against all kinds of conventions. There are reasons why we don't do that kind of thing. And if Russia does it to Ukrainians or to Americans, it would be outrageous. But the fact that Ukraine does it is kind of acceptable because we have identified Ukraine as clearly the good guys in this conflict. And that leads to, yeah, just really strange reporting among Western media and bad analysis among Western policymakers.
That was a great episode as well. I think that was episode number 13, also very much at the beginning. Western media on Ukraine. I can really recommend this to all listeners because it is still so shockingly accurate, right? There has been no process of review within any of these media outlets thinking, how did we cover the conflict in Ukraine and did we do anything wrong?
Yeah. No, there's no sense of self-reflection, which, by the way, is the story for almost everything, right? There's very little self-reflection with respect to major wars we started. People like to pretend that Libya doesn't exist because that is a bit of an uncomfortable feeling. We are now upset with Niger and Burkina Faso and Mali for being controlled by Russia and completely ignoring that we messed up really badly there. There is no serious analysis of Yemen. This is like such a common pattern, right? That we do not reflect on our own mistakes. And even if you don't care about the morality of that, even if you say, well, you know, it's a rough world and people die, at the very minimum, you need to understand it to make better decisions in the future for your own sake, right? To position yourself better in a very complex world. And we don't do that. We don't critically analyze our own behavior.
Nope. Another player that doesn't analyze its own behavior critically is Israel. And this one is just a great piece of, like, I don't know, I assume historical evidence at some point. You know how me in history class, I had to analyze paintings from the 17th century. You kind of think, what did the painter, what did they think? What did they try to represent, right? And you look at this. I don't know if at some point people will look back at our episodes on Israel and Gaza from October of 2023, because I mean, looking back at that episode from October 11th, I don't remember how your mood was during that episode, because I remember being very touched by that atrocious attack, right? It was very vivid. I remember I saw those videos and images, and I think you purposefully decided not to look at them, which I think also like made our analysis on it differ a little bit, because I think I was a lot more emotional about it. But already then we said, Israel, this is terrible. This is the worst thing that can happen to you, right? But now please don't make it worse. Please don't invade Gaza, right? And then you can see our process over a few weeks, because we recorded about on this topic every week, and how we're becoming more and more desperate for Israel not to invade and not to make those terrible mistakes that right, other countries, particularly within the West, have done in the past.
Yes, and I must point out that this wasn't because we're particularly brilliant. You just compared us to the great artists from the past as historical evidence. But this was because we had a very clear template for this, 9/11, which was a perfect case study of a country that is deeply damaged and hurt by a horrible atrocity. In the case of 9/11, 3,000 people dying. In the case of October 23, over 1,000 people dying and being kidnapped. Both cases enormously destructive, awful, horrible in every single way. And we know that the way that the United States reacted after 9/11, even if you don't care about other countries or human welfare around the world, was deeply, deeply damaging to the United States itself. And so applying that template to the situation of Israel was not particularly complicated. And it was completely obvious that Israel, if they weren't careful, were gonna shoot themselves horribly in the foot. And during that process, also do enormous damage to the Palestinians and others around them. And that's exactly, unfortunately, what happens. Unlike, you know, your average IR student who has studied international relations for 1 or 2 years, apparently the Netanyahu government and broader Israeli society had no patience about to learn about history and had no patience to reflect and just wanted to lash out. And as a result, they've deeply, deeply damaged their own security, their own future, as well as caused enormous human suffering around them.
Well, maybe they did learn the history, but they forgot about all of that history because they were so deep in their bubble, right? Like so like just ingrained in there, only seeing enemies around you. And that, unfortunately, on all levels, right? And this is another episode, episode 77 on Eurovision, right? Where, I mean, surprise, surprise, we didn't talk about the musical talents during Eurovision, but no, we talked about an incident where the Israeli delegation behaved in a really unpleasant way, like during the whole, you know, tournament, I think I can call it, right? And this kind of symbolized how through all areas and sectors of Israeli society, that approach to the world, that very confrontative approach, basically has just moved into that. And it's just shocking and sad, right? Because this was only 6 months after this. And now we look back at it and it hasn't really changed.
Yeah, and again, it's the same analysis applies. It's not just about the consequences for others, it's also about the consequences for Israel. There is nothing to be gained by being this antagonistic, this aggressive. You know, so the way that spokespeople over the past year and a half have been going around on TV stations and showed very, very little sympathy, very, very little humanity with respect to the plight of Palestinians, with respect to the plight of people living in Lebanon. It seems that, exactly as you said, they've dug a hole there in such a bunker mentality that they lash out against anyone who is somehow critical of anything they do. And that has very negative long-term consequences for Israeli society and for the position of Israel around the world. It is such a horrible example of self-inflicted pain, right? Even if you ignore the pain inflicted on the Palestinian people or others.
I mean, that's kind of the second part of this podcast series, right? If you want to divide it into maybe two parts, you can see the first one where we have the time and right the ability, like the just the mental space to record foundational and into like and really like right deep dives on the Western bubble. And from that moment onwards, right, from October 2023, it becomes a little bit, I don't want to call it reactionary, but we basically, there's so much happening in the world, and so many of the things that we explained in the foundational episodes, we could at that point see happening in the real life, right? So that's, you can almost see a break within the podcast series around that time, because then every week it was just about, oh, something like this, something happened here. We talked about this just a few episodes ago. These are the dynamics that are at play here.
Yeah, and this is one of the reasons why in last week's episode, so in episode 99, I generally displayed a little bit of kind of depression, which I usually don't really do in terms of international relations, because, you know, at some point everything seems a little bit repetitive. We've known horrible wars, we've known civilians dying over and over again, and it usually, you know, for most of my career, it didn't really affect me that much. But now we seem to be in such a free fall. Everything is happening exactly as you're saying, so fast and so out of control, not just with respect to Israel, not just with respect to the United States, but everywhere, that we are seeing the world change in front of us. And that's great news for our podcast, because every week we've got 10 topics that we can choose from at a minimum. It's great for my work as a consultant and as an academic, but it is really scary from a world's perspective, because it took hundreds of years to build up a lot of the good things that we build up. Because even though we are critical of the Western bubble and we are critical of Western behavior, there are some really, really good things that happened over the past 200 years in terms of internal institution building, in terms of respect for basic rights within Western society, at least. Holding power to account, not having overly destructive corruption or anything like that taking place in our societies. The past 200 years have been a slow process of building up towards hopefully a better tomorrow, which is one of the reasons why I've got so much sympathy for Fukuyama, despite him being wrong. And yet now, over the past year and a half, this is all just collapsing into some kind of ravine, and we don't know where it ends. We don't know what the end result will be like.
And this, what you're describing here, was already foreshadowed in particularly in episode 3, right? The hollowing out of institutions, also one of the all-time favorite episodes, if I look at the numbers, where we could just see that Western institutions, the ones that you've just mentioned and that have made us strong, right? That have made the West so strong and such a pleasant like place to live in as well, right? That's the reason why, I mean, we always say, hey, we're not doing this podcast to just criticize the West and basically end the project, but we're doing this because we actually like the original idea of the West and we just want the West to become better. So that was already foreshadowed in episode 3 from July 20, right, 2022. And then we again looked at this with the rise of right-leaning populism in episode 62, December 2023, when you could already see some form of darkness kind of laying over the West and some dark forces arising within that darkness. And they are now here. Hi. Hello, dark forces. How are you doing? Balder, why is that? What do we do now?
Well, it's very clear that we are increasingly scared and that we're increasingly stressed and panicked. And understandably so, because dynamics are happening without anyone being in control. And it is very difficult to see where this is heading. I made a joke at the beginning of the episode saying, hey, what happens when we reach episode number 1,000? I would be delighted if we reach episode number 1,000, because it means that, first of all, we haven't been cancelled since then. And secondly, that we are still free to say whatever we want to say. I don't think that's necessarily a given, the way we're heading right now. And a lot of that comes down to the behavior of people themselves, to individuals and the masses voting for parties, right? It's very easy to point our finger at Trump or to point our finger at Andrew Tate or whoever it is that we believe is a driver behind the darkness. But most of it comes from ordinary people who are now looking at the world and are afraid, are identifying enemies, are trying to protect what they have because they know that it might be taken away from them in the future, and therefore go to a very dark place and let very dark forces take over. And so probably the only thing we can hope for and that we can work towards, which is not a particularly spectacular solution and it's not at all guaranteed to work, is to appeal to the ordinary person walking around in Madrid, in Berlin, in New York, in London, in Paris, to actually go back to just basic decency and the foundations that we've been building up in Western liberal society, the things that we've been striving towards, trying to understand that in this complexity, we have to be kind and generous, not just towards ourselves, but also towards the other, towards the outsider, towards the immigrants, towards China, towards all those that don't necessarily seem like us, but that we still have to work with at a productive level and that we can't just identify as some kind of existential enemy. That will depend on the behavior of masses, not just on the behavior of leadership that we are seeing every day moving us closer towards the abyss.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on episode 100 of the Western Bubble podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout this episode or in the last 99 episodes, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. By the way, if we wanted to reach episode 1000, it would take us another 22 and a half years at the current pace. So thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Please make sure you join us again in 22 and a half years when we burst the Western bubble. Or hopefully by that point, you know, we will no longer have to burst it because it will have been burst. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Before I go into that, I'm just doing a quick calculation. I'll be close to 70 then. So I would be very pleased if we're still talking about these things like this by then, Dario. I look forward to it. The quote I took is by, I would say, an eternal figure, both in terms of quote as well as in actual history and policy making, Dr. King, Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "We are not makers of history, we are made by history."